welcome to a very special Overthoughts episode on the Overthink. December, guys, I don't know if you knew this, December used to bring the holiday season. We used to celebrate Christmas and then other holidays around this time. But for the past 3 years, it's meant Star Wars season, which is amazing, and I'm loving every second of it. Up and down, the movies might be good and bad, whatever. It's still Star Wars season, and that is an amazing thing compared to the first 20-something odd years of my life. So, and today, The Last Jedi, a Rian Johnson joint. And I'm Ben Helms, by the way. And with me this lovely evening are three of my closest confidants. We met up in the Bay Area this last weekend to celebrate our semi-annual tradition of drinking amazing beer, hanging out in San Francisco, and watching Star Wars. Yeah, and we have a lot of thoughts for you. And unfortunately, this time we got together and like had lunch and had to split. I think the 2 years ago when we saw The Force Awakens, we hung out for like 2 days after. And we had a lot of conversations about it.
Yeah, and whose fault is that, Ben? It's none of ours.
Is it my fault?
Know. Oh, okay. No, you saved us from not watching it at all.
Oh, cool. Okay. So yeah, anyway, first up, you know these two gentlemen from another Overthink show. What exactly am I watching here? Jason Helms and Dominic Lang. How's it going, guys?
Going good.
It's going well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're looking good. You're looking trim, fit.
Well, it's a bad name for a podcast because you're listening. Have we thought about that? You're not watching.
What exactly am I listening here? Would be the podcast about your podcast?
Yeah.
Let's note it to death.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, we would not be complete without our fourth member, with the master of movies, the senor of cinema, the film father himself, Jorge Castellanos. Real quick, how many times have you seen The Last Jedi?
Just two.
Oh, just two. Oh, come on.
The time we saw it, and then I saw it again, I saw it again yesterday.
So. But how many movies have you seen in addition to The Last Jedi
Since The Last Jedi?
Yeah.
Probably four.
Yeah, see, there you go.
Yeah. A man whose movie pass is just smoking every time he pulls it out. Man,
I think I needed a new card. The stripes got to wear it out.
Man, I got to get movie pass. Anyway, so first question to start it off. This is an all Last Jedi episode. No talking about other movies. We could be here for 3 hours, so this might be the most highly edited podcast we've ever done. We have a lot of thoughts, but first off,
Ben, let's remind our listeners: this is not a spoiler free podcast.
Spoilers ahead! All spoilers all the time.
Yeah, all spoilers all the time. So if you haven't seen the film, folks, run out and see it, and then come back and listen to us.
Rey is Luke's father. Get with it.
It's weird. So yeah, quick question. First of all, we'll go around the room and say, how many lightsabers do you give this film, or your little custom rating system? And then quickly, what is one thing that stood out to you about the film that you want to make sure we cover in our conversation tonight? Jason, you first.
Well, I have only two lightsabers. The one that my father made that was handed to me by an old hermit in the desert.
Sure.
I lost that in a mining colony. Anyway, I still have the second one that I built myself, but I give it both of those lightsabers, hypothetically.
Oh, wow. 100% lightsabers.
100% lightsaber.
Okay.
Kind of a greenish one and a bluish one. Anyway, they're both lightsabers.
Okay.
And the thing I wanted to talk most about is the idea of balance in the Force, something that was promised all along with Anakin, and something that we may or may not have achieved with Rey. I thought this film had one of the more interesting approaches to the idea of balance in the Force that we've seen.
Jorge, what about you?
I give it, I suppose, if I had my rack of Hattori Hanzo lightsabers, that I would probably give it 4 out of 5 lightsabers. And the thing that I probably want to talk most about, or at least get everybody's thoughts on, is how it's a woman-led galaxy now.
Nice, yeah.
And how I'm pretty happy about that.
Good call. Don, what about you, man?
I would give it 1 Darth Maul, double lightsaber.
Nice.
And 1 green lightsaber from Return of the Jedi.
Cool.
So, nice. And the thing I would love to talk about is whether or not, is there a difference between Luke's arc being a good character arc and a good arc for Luke?
I think Mark Hamill has thoughts on that, by the way.
I think he does.
Hey, Ben, how about you?
First, I just wanted to give it tiny little Porg lightsabers, because I would love the idea of a Porg wielding 2 lightsabers, just teeny weeny ones that he made himself. But I'm going to go with Kylo Ren's lightsaber, because it's big, it's entertaining, but it's kind of falling apart at the seams. And I'm going to talk about today Porgs. I want to talk about Porgs. We're definitely going to talk about them. We've already talked about them twice in the last 30 seconds. There will be a third time. But I want to talk about kind of the kiddish element, the childish type Some people call it, you know, the comedy. It was a little too light sometimes. And that kind of gets us into the, not that we have to talk about my thing first, but that just reminds me of the polarizing aspect of this film. And we're not going to make the whole thing about who liked this and who hated it and why necessarily. But I feel like this is a good place to start, because if you haven't seen this film, that's probably the thing you know about it from the news, mm-hmm. from Twitter, from whatever, is the fact that you have friends that are outraged about this film and you have friends that really liked it. So did we know that going, did you guys know that going in when you saw the film, and how did that affect you watching it? You didn't know it. I didn't know it either, but it was interesting between the four of us. That's kind of how it played out.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's interesting to me is that it's not a film where like people either go, yeah, it's really great, or just there's no like, meh reaction to this movie.
Yes. Yeah.
There's no kind of like, ah, it's all right. Right. Like, I think, and that's, for me, that's really emblematic of Johnson taking some bold moves with the storytelling. Whether that pays off for you or not, that's going to determine your like or dislike of the film itself. But I think the fact that it's garnering strong reaction is overall a good thing.
Yeah, I had really strong positive reactions. First off, I was really entertained. You know, I'm still 12 in my heart, and this movie was for me. But second off, Rian Johnson showed me some of the things that I did not like about The Force Awakens, definitely about the prequels, and some even about the original trilogy, and kind of corrected those. And I really liked the way that he flipped a finger to previous Star Wars canon while still kind of remaining in his lane. He wasn't going to tear it all down, but he also was going to speak up. Especially, I mean, the most obvious is taking kind of all the loose threads that are hanging at the end of The Force Awakens, which, you know, oh, what's Rian Johnson going to do with that? And he basically just threw them all away and started from scratch. The easiest example of that is we've got that big, you know, showy thing where Rey is handing Luke the lightsaber. What's going to happen? Mm-hmm. And it's treated as a gag. And Luke throws it over his shoulder. And that was the most visual way of presenting, you know, no, I'm not doing that. I'm doing something else.
Yeah, and right off the bat, too.
Yeah, the deconstruction I thought was so strong, and that like I felt that notion and idea most prevalent in Luke's arc and Luke's story, and even just his dialogue in terms of the most vocal critic of the Jedi is Luke,
the only Jedi.
Yeah, and the fact that that whole scene about how the fact that he became a legend, the fact that he bought his own legend, he believed his own kind of log line, that is what led to his downfall, the downfall of that Jedi temple. I thought it was really interesting and really just like uncomfortable in a way, because I'm not used to a deconstruction of mythos in Star Wars. I'm used to Star Wars like being mythos and just kind of like,
yeah,
taking the myth and adding lasers. But to deconstruct it, I think that's where I felt a tension, but also where I found it really interesting.
Yeah.
It's interesting. The more I unpack this, it's the opposite of episode one, mm-hmm. for me emotionally and maybe mm-hmm. intellectually too. But where I came out of episode one, I was 13 years old, loved it, was like, that was a lot of cool lightsaber fights, right? Obviously, the older I got, the more I was like, wow, that movie's mostly BS. And this one seemed like I came out of it and was frustrated by a lot mm-hmm. of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not that I'm special, but the biggest negatives I've heard about it are the nerds, right? The Star Wars fanatics who are saying that it messed with the Jedis as a whole, right? It messed with who Luke is at his core. There's even a video that our friend Richard Nile sent me about 10 minutes ago. That's Mark Hamill talking about Luke and when he first read the script compared to after he talked with Rian Johnson and when they started filming it, how he rejected it originally and was really pissed when he read the script, mm-hmm. saying, this is not Luke. Luke, a Jedi would never, especially Luke, would never give up on being a Jedi. That's not a thing they would do unless it's the dark side. It goes back to the George Lucas, like, it's good or bad, light or dark. That, you know, it's right. It's mm-hmm. this dichotomy. Mm-hmm. And I think Rian Johnson was breaking a lot of, just like Jason was talking about, breaking a lot of those assumptions or a lot of those kind of rules that the movie set up with the original and even in the prequel set up of the Force, of who Luke is, what the dark side and light side is. And those are the parts I loved about the film. I love exploring that. You're right. It's breaking J.J. Abrams mystery box, right? That's the stupid lost mystery box thing that J.J. talks about. He's like, doesn't matter what's in this box. As long as this box exists, people will watch, is my interpretation of what the mystery box is.
Right. Well, it's kind of like Rian Johnson took a dump in the mystery box.
Exactly. Exactly. He didn't open the mystery box. He got rid of the mystery box.
And we have our episode title.
Yeah.
But yeah, the whole point, he wasn't like, well, we have to answer all these things that JJ asked. He's like, those things don't really matter that much to me.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about things that have never been explored.
Exactly. Like Kylo Ren, his
yes.
kill the past motivation. I was incredibly impressed by Kylo as just a character. And to have that such a strong motivation throughout and such like, that's a characterization I don't think we've seen in Star Wars, and just made him far more of a relatable character, and even feeling like some empathy or compassion toward Kylo.
Just think if we would have had that kind of quality in Anakin Skywalker, how much better the prequels would have been.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How much more interesting the dynamic of the transformation into Darth Vader, that whole process would have been, instead of us being able to, in large part, dismiss it because that was just treated so poorly.
Yeah.
And we didn't have a complex character in that sense.
That's one of my big, and a lot of people's biggest gripe with the prequels, is the fact that they had such a good opportunity, that 6 hours to take the protagonist and turn him into an antagonist. Now, how cool and rare opportunity that is. And obviously we've seen that done very well. Some Breaking Bad's a great example of that. But to me, that's the same thing with Kylo, in the sense that even though they give you some backstory of Kylo and how he first turned to Snoke, I guess, even though Luke says that Snoke already had a hold of him, it seems like Kylo's just a bad guy, no matter what. There was never a point when I was like, oh, maybe he will turn good. There was no reason for him to turn good.
Mm.
But at the same time, I don't know why he turned bad other than a misunderstanding with Luke. So I was frustrated with his character because it seemed like it wasn't that complex. It was just kind of, he's a bad guy.
Oh, okay.
My feeling was the opposite. In episode 7, I sort of never bought that Kylo was close to redemption. I always felt like he was intentional and just manipulative of Han Solo in the scene where he kills him. That he intended to kill him, he followed through on that killing, and there was never any glimmer of hope in reality. I mean, I don't know if that was the intent, but that's how I read it.
I read it like there was.
And then in this film, I felt more conflicted about, is Rey actually getting to Kylo? Is Rey close to... I didn't fully buy... No, I didn't have Rey's mindset about Kylo. I was always much more suspicious than she was, but I was less suspicious than I was in episode 7, which is weird. And I think that's because they did a better job of developing Kylo as a more rounded character in this film, even though, you know, he's still the arch-villain and has to have the attributes of an arch-villain in order for the film to work.
But I feel like even Kylo did a better job of, like, every villain thinks they're the hero of the story.
Sure.
And that motivation to kill the past, to do away with Luke, to do away with Snoke, to do away with any of all the BS that came before. For in his mind, that makes his motivation heroic. And I thought that in that way, I felt like he maybe still is the villain, but he is a more fleshed out villain.
Hmm. Yeah. And I think there's certainly ambiguity in both Force Awakens and Last Jedi in terms of Kylo. And we want to pin him down. We want to know how conflicted was he. I think there's room to believe he was not conflicted in either of them. And I think there's a lot of room to believe that he was conflicted in each. And I like that these are movies that want to give us that and want to give us a place to argue and debate.
That's a good call.
I do. The one thing I would have preferred is when he reaches out to Rey after defeating Snoke, his offer seems malevolent.
Yes.
You know, let's rule the universe with an iron fist is implied. Yeah.
Right. It's obviously even reaches out with his right hand, just like Darth Vader in Empire. Right? It's mimicking, obviously, that scene.
And let us connect those dots, you know? Yeah. You don't need to give us that. In fact, I would have loved it if he said, you know, we can bring peace to the Empire. You and me. We can give your parents' death meaning. They didn't have to be nothing.
Yeah.
We can turn Jakku from nothing into a place where people pilgrimage to remember where Rey came from, and to remember when peace united the universe and birthed something better than the Galactic Republic, where all people are at peace with each other. If he presented something like that, how can Rey say no? And yet, you know that there is evil there. You know that that's not just benevolence, that that's selfishness, his desire to rule over others. And so Rey would have actually been caught in a bind. But the way he presented it, there was no debate for Rey. She had to show courage in that moment, but it wasn't, she didn't seem actually seduced in any way by his offer.
Yeah, and I flash back on that scene in episode 3 when Darth at that point is rejecting Padme and trying to convince her that, you know, they're on the volcanic world, that, you know, they need, he needs to be the supreme leader, and he and she can rule the galaxy. Mm-hmm. And even that, as ludicrous and horrifying as it seemed to Padme in the way that she reacted, was quite evident of that. Even that seemed more attractive, or more potentially attractive, than the way Kylo presented his choice to Rey.
Yeah,
I totally agree.
Yeah, I think something that the film did amazingly well, and it's just Rian Johnson all over the place, is the foreshadowing of every plot line. And he did it in a way that's so Brick, Brothers Bloomy, loopery, right? Those are his three movies. And in the sense that it is, when it gets to the end, whatever twist or climax, denouement, whatever it is at the end that makes you realize, like, oh my gosh, I could have predicted this, but at the same time, there's no way I would have in watching this the first time. A couple times, and I had to look up some of these quotes, so I couldn't remember them from a week ago, but when Luke says to Rey at the very beginning, like, I think it's the first conversation they have, this isn't going the way you want it to go. I'm not going to walk out and defeat the First Order with a laser sword.
Yep.
Which is how he ends the movie, doing that. But at the same time, he doesn't do that. So it's just like subverting the subversion of, it's so good.
I read a quote by critic Matt Zoller-Seitz, who says one of the great joys he has in this film is how Rian Johnson is fully invested in what he called the street illusionist panache. The source of delight is always in the hand you weren't looking at.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Right? And that's evident throughout the film, and I think that's exactly what you're talking about, Ben.
Yeah, yeah. And then I think speaking directly to the fans, he says to Rey, and I think Kylo both, the same sentence, which is something to the effect of, everything you said is wrong. I think it's a fuller sentence than that, but that's the idea, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's speaking directly to what they just said. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to defeat you. I'm going to do this, whatever it is. But also to the Star Wars nerds that hate the film, like, everything you're expecting from Star Wars, from the Force, from Luke, from lead characters, whatever, I'm going to kind of flip it and, like, get ready. That's what's going to happen. He says at the beginning and at the end of the film. So I thought that was cool. Mm-hmm. It made me realize, I guess, that those, that obviously not an accident, but it obviously was done with a lot of intentionality in breaking those assumptions and stereotypes that we all have about the things that have been kind of unsaid, or things that we assume were permanent things. Like the way, Jason, let's get to the subject you want to talk about, the balance in the Force.
Yeah, and I think one way to get there is talking about, you know, everything you said was wrong. There's an incredible kind of respect for the past, for canon, for scripture, in trying to destroy those things that this movie is interested in. That seems really
literally does that at one point.
Yeah, he literally destroys, or tries to destroy. It's great. Master Yoda appears just as he's about to destroy the sacred Jedi texts. Master Yoda makes some quick jokes about them and burns them to the ground. And Luke, who is just about to destroy them himself, is mortified. How dare you? They're the sacred Jedi texts. And both in his effort to destroy them and in his sorrow over them being destroyed, shows that he doesn't understand them.
By the way, real quick.
Yeah.
Top 5 scene in Star Wars history.
It's fantastic. That scene was freaking amazing.
Puppet Yoda's back. It's just, it's all looking good. Some amazing subtext in that scene. It looked beautiful. Keep going.
And then at the end of the movie, really subtly, I think Finn opens up a drawer to get some bandages for Rose. and there he sees but doesn't even notice them.
Yeah.
That sacred Jedi texts with which Rey stole. Another act of sacrilege. She stole the sacred Jedi texts, and by stealing them, has passed them on, right? And will continue them. And it's a whole lesson about the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law, right?
Mm.
What should we do? How do we enliven these texts? Well, we live them out. And so one of the big things for me about the idea of the Force, dark side, light side, the thing I don't like is dark side is always active. Light side is always passive, right? Dark side has fear and anger and suffering. Well, so does the light side have no empathy? Does the light side not fear things that would be appropriate to fear? Fear is a great instinct to have. Mm-hmm. What about a just anger? There is a place for a just anger that should be there. Why does the light side lack these things? And the idea of, you know, Obi-Wan sacrificing himself, being completely passive in that moment to die. I never liked that passive idea of the light side. We see Luke do it at the end of Jedi, where he sacrifices himself. He puts the laser sword down and sacrifices himself. And then Darth Vader redeems himself by being active and killing the Emperor, which, of course, it wouldn't be a light side thing, so he couldn't be redeemed at all, it seems like, because, again, the light side is supposedly passive. And Luke, in one sense, is the most light side Jedi ever. He has absolutely done that perfectly by removing himself completely from the Force. How much more passive can you be?
Wow.
He went off to an island, and he just sat there alone and then cut himself off from the Force and then learned how wrong that was. So I know I'm in the middle of a soliloquy, and I'm going to break it up with a Zen koan.
Bring it.
The end of Genjo Koan, which is the opening of Dogen's Shobo Genzo, one of the most famous chapters of Zen scripture.
Would you say page turners these are?
Page turners these are. No, no. Okay. You need to pause on every page and consider. I've actually read an entire book on this 1 4-page chapter.
Of course.
All right. So guy goes to a Zen master, sees the Zen master fanning himself and says, "Master, the nature of wind is permanent and there's no place it does not reach. Why then do you fan yourself?" And the master says, "Although you understand that the nature of wind is permanent, you do not understand the meaning of its reaching everywhere." "Well, then what, master, is the meaning of it reaching everywhere?" And the master just kept fanning himself. And then the monk bowed deeply, finally understanding it. And the idea there is passivity, activity, right? If the nature of the universe is to be everywhere and everything's perfect and you're real Zen with everything, you just go, "Okay, cool, man, just let it be." And then you never do anything, nothing gets done.
Mm.
And instead, the nature of the Zen master, the nature of the enlightened person, is to act with rather than to be passive. And there's a really big difference between acting with and being passive. And being passive has nothing to do with Zen, has nothing to do with the light side, has nothing to do with the Force. Mm-hmm. The Force is active. The Force is awakened in the last movie. And Luke is there to teach us that the Force does not need us to just be passive. It needs us to act along with it. Mm-hmm. And even to make mistakes, because that is part of the journey. Failures are our most important teachers.
Nice.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I never thought about the idea that, obviously, Yoda tells Luke that that the light side is, I think, peaceful and passive are two of the words he uses. But I never thought about the idea that even wielding a lightsaber isn't passive. So that's pretty contradictory. Dom, would you want to jump right into Luke's arc?
Yeah. And I guess kind of putting a button on that section on the Force.
Yeah.
Even when Luke kind of first guides Rey into that meditation and asks her what she sees both and sees that the Force is something that, you know, binds the universe together, but it's not necessarily, you know, strictly malevolent or benevolent. It's not strictly good or evil.
It's literally volant. That's what Force means. You're awesome. I love you, Dom. Go on.
And so for me, that was kind of the moment where I was like, this is really interesting. And even that scene where Luke asks Rey, like, "Why are you here?" And Rey gives the, like, "The resistance needs you." And he, "Why are you here?" And really just hones in on Rey. And I don't have the exact quote, but, you know, she speaks to the internal conflict within her. Like, there has been something that I don't know what it is, but it's awakened and I don't know what to do with it and don't know what it's going to be or what it's going to look like. And I told you guys this, but I can imagine, you know, a 6-year-old, a 16-year-old, a 30-year-old, a 60-year-old, and a 90-year-old hearing that speech and going, yeah, like, that's me. Like, to be in a moment where something within is erupting and you don't know how to express that and you don't know how to share that or what it's going to look like when you share that. And so with Luke and his arc, I think where I struggle, maybe just to like throw it out there and help, like help me out on this, is I think the arc of a once legendary figure who in his later years has come to regret and rue some of the actions of the past, doesn't want to teach a new kind of like the new generation, and eventually comes to a redeeming or reconciling of his past. I think that's like, that's a beautiful arc, and like processing through one's regret and transgression. Is that the arc that is best for Luke Skywalker? Because I guess I felt conflict in that, like, I didn't feel, it just felt dissonant for some reason. I'm still trying to place it to where, like, ending Return of the Jedi and knowing where Luke ends there in terms of just emotionally, where his head's at, and to now here in episode 7 and 8 as a recluse, as an angry, embittered individual. I don't know. I guess like I just need help getting there is what I'm saying. Because again, I like the arc. I just don't know if I like the arc for Luke.
Mm. What if Luke hadn't tried to kill Kylo Ren? And we know he didn't try. According to Luke, he thought about it. He considered it.
According to Luke. Right? From a certain point of view.
From a certain point of view.
Yeah.
He pulled out his lightsaber and then changed his mind.
And we'll all watch Rashomon again.
Yeah, exactly. We should.
Yeah. And I thought that was handled really well.
Really great. Lovely tip of the hat to Rashomon.
Yeah. So if you're asking if Luke had not tried to kill...
Yeah, was Kylo already on the track to the dark side? And... You know, Luke says that he saw this growing up in him, and he saw mm-hmm. that he was so far further along than he'd ever known. But it doesn't mean that he was there. And for me, it was something about fatherhood and parenting and child rearing and letting your children make their mistakes. And he attempted to step in, and he couldn't separate himself from his child and say, I realized I had made a mistake. No, you hadn't, Luke. No. Kylo Ren was the one making a mistake. You didn't make a mistake. And that was his failure. Now, I'm with you, Dom, in that we don't get to see the 25 years in between. He says there was balance to the Force for a while. And we can see that that kind of balance could build a kind of pride in him where he would think, wow, look at all that I've done. I have to keep everything perfect now. I have to keep everything balanced. And that could lead to that moment there. So I think it is connected, and if there's anyone to blame for why we don't get more of the arc, it's George Lucas, who decided to make different movies in between.
I guess I almost, like, this morning, I would almost want episode 7 to be the years of training at the Jedi Temple and the influence of Snoke, and then there's the, like, the temple fight and Knights of Ren, and Luke goes away to the island. And then episode 8 is episode 7, and this is the last one, to where then, like, I guess it's just so much of that arc and motivation, I think, is so rich, and there's too many gaps, it feels like, for us to just kind of like take and go like, oh, okay. Because then there's no significance. Like, I think killing Snoke is a great twist. I don't feel anything. Because I've not spent time with Snoke. I've not, like, it bears no, like, outside of a holy shit, and then 20 seconds, and you're in this amazing, amazing fight sequence in the throne room. But the like resonance of that murder, I don't think is there.
And not only the resonance, but the gravity of that event in the power structure of the dark side, let's call it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Darth kills the Emperor and saves Luke and really redeems himself in the sense of reverts to Anakin Skywalker, sort mm-hmm. of lets Darth Vader go. We had lived with the Emperor and Darth in relationship long enough to feel something about that death
yeah.
in a
yeah.
way that I think you're yearning for, that I'm hearing mm-hmm. from you, Dom.
Totally.
And we don't have any of that with Snoke and Kylo. And given how old Kylo is in episode 7 and 8,
mm-hmm.
that relationship couldn't have been that many years. It certainly wasn't as many years as the relationship that Darth and the Emperor had. Right. So there's probably not a whole lot of backstory there to learn about, even though some of it might be key. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of more interested in what happened to Luke to make him feel like he was the man, to the mm-hmm. extent that he had the hubris to make the same failed choices about training a Jedi that his master had and he'd seen be so recklessly resulting. Right?
Yeah.
That he got to a mental state where he believed he was the Jedi savior and decided to train all these Jedis and it went horribly bad.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm less interested in how did it go horribly bad than in what got him to the place of feeling like he was just the savior. You know, the mm-hmm. savior that he comes to reject. The whole arc of him in this film, in episode 8, of isolation, hermitage, and disconnection from the Force and everything else, he's gone to, quote-unquote, the hardest place to find in the galaxy. I can relate to that because of the level of brokenness that he exhibits in, you know, when from the moment that Rey meets him. Yeah. And in that whole island sequence, you know, he looks terrible, man. He looks like the miles have been bad,
mm-hmm.
and you can see it all over his face.
Yeah.
And when we start to learn that this is the result of him having this huge failure that he can't get past, right? And mm-hmm. that on top of it, he learns that the failure now has cost him Han Solo.
Yeah.
A guy that he loved and was mm-hmm. integral to his existence. So I buy that side of it, and I'm more curious about what led him to.
Yeah, yeah. And I, what I appreciate about the movie is that it asks a lot of interior questions, which again feels different than other Star Wars films. Like the prequels, for good or ill, like a lot of stuff happened. Like the plot summary is a couple of pages. And this, in terms of like plot and things happening, it's far shorter.
Yeah.
The list is far shorter, but interior, more things Huge. Happen and more questions are asked than I think any film previous.
At least it feels that way.
Let's compare it to the gap in the character arc of Luke between Empire and Jedi.
Mm.
Luke ends Empire, getting his butt kicked, finding out Darth Vader's his dad, losing a hand, crying, ugly crying.
Yeah.
It's not a good look on him. And he opens Jedi by coming into Jabba's palace like a ninja and defeating, what's the name of the monster? The
Rancor.
Rancor in single combat without his lightsaber. And he's just a boss and mm-hmm. so in control of himself and so composed. Huge character change there. And I've never actually learned what happened in between.
Yeah.
Right? I assume he did some training of some kind. I assume because right. Master Yoda was very clear that his training was not complete. And so at some point between Empire and Jedi, he completed his training on his own, lifted some rocks. I don't know. And so maybe the question isn't, is it okay to have the character kind of change off screen like that? Because that's a huge change.
It is.
But the way that it's dealt with, because I never questioned it in Jedi. Okay. I never went and said, hey, wait, this isn't Luke I remember. He was real whiny last time.
Mm-hmm.
What happened, guys? And maybe there's something, maybe Rian Johnson didn't handle it as well in the way that he introduced Luke here.
Again, just because it's Luke and his arc, since that's been one of the major points of contention, I just wanted to, like, work it out with you guys, you know?
I guess I was, as far as Luke's arc is concerned, you know, regardless of the details of what happened with him,
mm-hmm.
you know, by the end of the film, we've lost Luke.
Yeah.
And so by the end of episode 7 and episode 8, we've lost Han and Luke. And I never would have suspected that would have happened, given the fact that Carrie Fisher died.
Right.
Yeah.
And I thought for sure we're going to see the loss of Leia in this film in episode 8 before we see the loss of Luke.
Mm-hmm.
I just, you know, I was surprised by that.
That was one of the most distasteful scenes in all of Star Wars, too. I thought when they fake killed her.
And then when she was floating in space. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was really distasteful.
Why?
Because she's dead in real life.
Oh,
and they had this moment of her floating in space, like with frost on her face. I was like, Oh, like that's a shitty way for her to die. But like we get to see her like dead floating away and like pay her respect eternally as it happens. And then she like flies back and is in a coma for the next hour. And she doesn't die at the end. It was just kind of like this weird, like maybe it was just because she's passed away in real life that I thought that, but it also seemed kind of pointless in like other than to, I don't know, it would be distract MacGuffin, red herring, whatever it is to be like, yeah, she's dead. Cause she's dead in real life. Just kidding. She's back. She's not really dead, guys. Like that just seemed like really insensitive at the very least.
If she hadn't died, which according to Rian Johnson, her death did not change this movie.
And her role, she has a big role, obviously, towards the end of the film.
Yeah, so she died after principal photography was done.
Sure, yeah, sure.
So this scene was already filmed. Maybe the CGI wasn't done for it, but this was the way it was going to happen. And if she hadn't died, I don't think it would have been, it wouldn't have been distasteful towards her death because she wouldn't be dead.
Sure.
But it would have fit. It made sense. But I was with you. In that moment, I expected, okay, I spent the entire movie saying, just, oh my gosh, just kill off Leia. And the reason was because it was breaking my heart every time I saw her.
Exactly. I'm not saying it was right or wrong. Exactly. It was more just like that's what I couldn't get around the fact that it felt so uncomfortable while it was happening.
I loved it also because of that, because I kept getting to say goodbye to her.
Yeah, we want to see more of her.
I haven't seen her in this kind of role in, you know, front and center like this.
Yeah.
In a long time. You know, there's that 30 Rock episode from about a decade ago, but other than that, I really haven't seen her in much. And so to get to see Carrie Fisher and really spend some time with her was really nice, despite the fact that I was always worried she was going to die.
Jorge, maybe this is a good lead-in for you, but not just having Leia as part of the cast, but just a whole bunch of fully formed and just dimensional women characters.
Yeah, as well. I mean, I just... You know, maybe it's a touchstone of our times, an intentional one by Rian in writing it this way. Maybe it's the natural evolution of the current trilogy that we're in and how it was constructed by JJ and Kathleen and everyone else. But, you know, when you choose Rey as the one who has an awakening of the Force and who's going to be your through the trilogy character, hero, then you can either choose to make her a one-off as far as, oh, she's the only girl that's strong, or you can continue the legacy that was created in large part by Carrie Fisher's writing notes during episodes, 4, 5, and 6,
mm-hmm.
where she made Leia of a Force far greater than was originally written on the page and far more than the frivolous character perhaps that George Lucas had envisioned. You know, she gave, Carrie gave that character depth and power and strength and smarts. She's the smartest person in Star Wars.
Yeah.
You know, by far. She's the one that figures everything out. She's the one you want to follow. You know, there's other heroes that are macho and whatever and can do things, but she's the one that you want to follow. She's the inspirational force. And to see them choose, you know, in episode 7 to make Rey the hero Jedi, and to see that, you know, continue to take steps towards deeper fruition, to see the other women, even the brand new character,
Admiral Holdo.
Well, two of them really. Rose and Vice Admiral Holdo, be so great, and especially Vice Admiral Holdo to be so. I was listening to some videos today of the writers talking about that, the writers and the production team talking about that character, and about Laura Dern talking about that character, how Ryan really intended for that character to be fully feminine, perhaps ethereal, perhaps non-human, but perhaps more humanoid than human, and flirty with Poe, but also not give up an inch of her power, and not be a weak person, a weak woman, or one that has to go when she's promoted because Leia's in a coma. One that doesn't have to go dress up in a military uniform to assert her power.
Yeah.
She's just in her beautiful gown, which is how she always is, we assume. And Laura Dern kind of described it as Ryan wanting to create that character being beautiful and lovely and light and ethereal, but with the power of a prima ballerina, you know, that can hold all those things at the same time. And I just think that's awesome. I'm really, really happy that we have her as an example, and through Leia's example in this film, and Rey, of course, and even Rose, we have this set of strong, powerful women that I think are the strongest characters in a lot of ways in episode 8.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the real heroes across a lot of things that they do and a lot of things that they stand for.
Yeah. It feels like episode 8, the women demonstrate most like what it means to be part of a rebellion, like what it means to resist. And you, like, from the opening fight scene with Paige, who sacrifices her life, like an act of nobility, then going into with Rose and her kind of plot line, which unfortunately, like, as I love her as a character, I wish the plot line had more connection. What I learn about her, I love. And even just like those scenes with the stable kids to like communicate what it means to resist, what it means to be part of something greater than yourself. Like, she's the one who communicates that to the kids. And even Laura Dern, Vice Admiral Holdo, her moment of going light speed into the other ships, the beautiful operatic moment. And Rose at the very end telling Finn, like, this is how we win, not by killing, destroying what we hate, but by saving what we love. And I just thought that, I mean, that, like, that hit me. That was power
big
right
time
there. And yeah. So yeah, the female characters in this film have the most to share and the most to communicate.
And that was, to me, that was speaking directly to the world. But I was saying United States in 2016, 2017. I was like, hey guys, that's, you don't win by just hating, but just fulfilling that. I mean, that goes back to the dark side too, right? It's all hate, but instead saving what you love is really how you build each other up. And that's how you win, whatever that looks like in real life too, right? That's the thing to do.
And that's also why the message of the film cannot be that passivity is good.
Right. Right.
This is a historical moment when being active is important.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
You know, it kind of leaves us. I was having thoughts now. My thoughts turned towards, where has this movie left us?
Yeah.
And where are we headed in episode 9? And so we've got a situation that we've had before with our main Jedi character in training and the state of the rebellion or the resistance or whatever. I mean, it's dwindled down to hardly anyone as an effective force. They're kind of in hiding, like what happened at the end of episode 3, where, you know, by the time we get to the beginning of episode 4, it's Obi-Wan, the the hermit in the desert that nobody even knows he's called Obi-Wan. Mm-hmm. It's just old Ben Kenobi. And we've got what really is the only Jedi left sort of in isolation and with no one yet to train. And then quickly he disappears. And all we're left with is Yoda, who's about to disappear as well, barely training Luke. And then, like you said, Ben, at the end of or between episode 5 and 6, Luke trains himself, apparently, because there's no other Jedi to train him. And so that's what we've got now. We've got Rey needing to train herself because there's no other Jedi to train her. And everybody's sort of running away. And I think it's a really great, a pregnant place to be. It's going to birth some interesting things. But I'm not afraid of it because we've seen it before in the sense of we've had those circumstances before. And there's been a whole lot of interesting stuff created out of those circumstances.
Yeah, I think there's a sense in which this doesn't feel like a sad ending. You know, it felt a very hopeful, exciting ending. It was definitely an upbeat ending. And yet, for me, this is just as downer of an ending as Empire, if not more so, in that there is no rebellion left. There's no resistance left, right? They can literally fit inside the Millennium Falcon, and they do.
Well, I'll say that, you know, they keep talking about from the base on the planet, what's it called?
Crate.
They kept sending out signals to the diaspora, hoping someone would hear and show up. No one, as far as we know, showed up. We don't even know if anybody heard other than Luke. And I think he heard for other reasons. He was on a different wavelength.
Lando heard. Lando's coming in episode 9.
Yeah, well, I
guarantee.
So yeah,
really,
the people that we're left with on the Millennium Falcon feel like the whole of the resistance, but I can't say that there aren't other people out there that we haven't met yet. And what about the little kids that exhibit the powers of the Force and haven't awakened to the fact that they're part of the resistance, but maybe have? You know, so that's the pregnancy that I sort of feel is going to birth or has the potential to birth a really interesting story arc in episode 9.
Yeah. And with the changeover from an older generation to a younger one, that also means I think none of us are excited about child actors going forward in the Star Wars films, but Rey, Finn, and Poe will likely be the seniors of the Resistance. Leia is not going to be a big part of episode 9. I think we can all assume.
I think so.
And that means that, like that kid with the broom, hopefully he'll be at least 14 or 15 by the time episode 9 picks up. You know, it's going to be a little bit more Riverdale. It's going to be a high school resistance. It's going to be a very young resistance, which can be exciting as well. I haven't seen that in a Star Wars film, and I think that'll be cool.
And they're setting up Finn to lead the way, I think, in the sense that from an emotional standpoint, I think Poe might be like the military leader, right? But in the sense that through two films, he's tried to run away 4 separate times that I can think of, maybe more. So it'd be cool to see him step up in the 9th film, and I'm assuming kind of redeem that side of him.
Well, he kind of did at the very end of episode 8, right? I mean, the one that makes the speech that says, we've got to make the stand here. We've got to fight. So he's not running away. He's staying.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And even just tries to make the ultimate sacrifice by, you know, flying into the cannon, which Rose circumvents.
Yeah,
but that's the farthest from running away he's been, and I kind of feel like that's over with for him. If they revisit that, I'll kind of feel a little bit like, come on, he's not that conflicted anymore. Yeah. At least not about that.
It's obvious that we're headed towards the love story of Poe and Finn, and I think we're all excited about that. I think everyone's
here we go,
shipping them hard.
Yeah, you are.
Ben, we were talking about the like children being part of the rebellion, but we haven't talked about like just the child element and like the child audience for Star Wars, and you wanted to hit that.
Yeah, we don't need to spend much time on it. We talked about it in person, and I think everyone has their own opinions, people listening to this, what they think on this, so I don't know if I'm going to change any opinions. I don't even know if I have a strong one, but the thing that pulled me out of the film most was the goofy side of it. It was from the very beginning when and it, even before the lightsaber was thrown, but it was the Poe calling Hux over the intercom, right?
The like, the crank yankers in Hux, space.
Hux with an H. I'll wait. I'll hold that, which is funny. I agree. Yeah. Like, I don't think that's stupid or not funny, but it just seemed really out of place. And it was, it, I guess it set the tone for the film in the sense that it was going to be action, drama, comedy, sci-fi, all in one. And that's kind of what Star Wars is. And I've been reminded online, the more I think about it, the more I research, the more I read comments of people that have that same view of, hey, maybe was this a little too light, was that a couple things. One is, I saw Star Wars when I was 0 years old, right? Like it existed before I was born for almost 10 years. And wow, that makes me sound old. But the fact that like I've grown up with this thing and now I'm 32 and it's trying to appeal to 0 year olds. And it says like the same people, like people will be born this year. My daughter will be born in a month and Star Wars will have fully existed. So her whole adolescence will be seeing these 9, 10, 12, 15 films. And it needs to appeal to her at every level, at every age. And it, that's really hard to do. And it fails and succeeds a lot at that, I think.
No, exactly. And even when they were on Canto Bite and it's the, the Fathirs or Fathirs, the giant like dog, greyhounds, dog horses.
Right.
There was a kid behind me at, in the theater and they come on screen. And he turns to his dad and is like, Dad, they look like giant puppies. Like, he was pumped to see him.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, right. Like, Star Wars is for kids.
Yeah.
And that's, like, that's when I saw Star Wars. When I was 6 or 7. And it was just, like, this larger-than-life thing. And, yeah, like, the Fathirs or the Crystal Critters, the Porgs. Like, this movie, another, like, kind of feather in its hat. Like this movie feels epic in the sense that like, it just feels like a big movie and going to different planets, experiencing different creatures, different races of people. Like it just feels the sweep of it feels immense. And for kids to like go to the casino and see all these weird and crazy creatures, like, I'm sure for some kids, that's their favorite scene because it's just so wild and out of this world.
Yeah. And I think it might be me going back and watching the originals again. Seeing this one for a second time might give me some more context. Mm-hmm. But there's plenty of slapstick parts in the original three of Han Solo putting his hand over C-3PO's mouth when he's talking on Hoth.
Yeah. Or like the chess game with the like wrestling monsters.
It's just pure slapstick. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that does exist, obviously, throughout Star Wars, but and maybe it's just me getting old, but that totally pulled me out a few times. To me, the biggest negative, I guess, that I couldn't get away from also, I just said the last thing was the biggest. This is also the biggest, is the how bloated it felt. And you talked about how simple the plot was, right? It's a 2.5 hour chase scene, basically.
Yeah, a very slow chase scene.
Very slow chase scene, but it's... It also shoves in so much stuff, and that's part of it being the 10th film or whatever in this epic, that it has to meet so many expectations. But my problem with that is it subverts them on purpose, so why try to even meet them? Why try to have a scene with, I don't know, all these things that just felt like they were kind of forced in?
That's a fair thing, and if there's a lot in the movie, interior-wise, I struggle sometimes with it because I don't feel like there were many scenes or sequences of momentum.
Right.
There were a lot of scenes intercut.
Right.
But it too often felt like scene.
Yeah.
Scene. There wasn't one thing happening causing this and then here and then causing that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And there were a few amazing set pieces, right? The bombing run, the lightsaber fight, the big thing at the end on the salt planet. But they felt disconnected.
Yeah. That was my major contention with it.
Yeah.
If I had to fix it, I think we would all cut the casino.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And I think one easy way to do that and still have Rose's story is to have it be much more the story of them getting into the Star Destroyer, whatever the thing is, the Dreadnought, Snoke's flagship.
Yeah.
The Snoke ship. And, that could have had all those same kind of adventure beats in it, BB-8 doing his thing, them getting locked up, them getting free, all kinds of things like that. And we can completely cut the character of DJ. And there's a couple things that get lost from that. One is the interesting thing that DJ has about good guys, bad guys, arms dealers.
Yeah.
And the other is the idea of, you know, the poor, the downtrodden, the people that all of this exists on top of. Mm-hmm. And some of them being, you know, at the end, it's revealed Force Active and part of the resistance. That's really important to build the next one. So it actually is a really important story thing that I'm not sure they could have told in space. They needed to land on a planet to do
that. Which I'm fine. I think either, like, those are, and those are, like, two valid story threads. But again, going back to the argument of, like, is this just too much movie for one movie? Like, those are two awesome lines and two awesome arcs. But to just, like, oh, these one awesome arc and another awesome arc, we'll just put them together. And it'll be great. Like, it actually makes the two arcs worse.
Yeah.
By the way, Rian Johnson did say today that there's going to be 20 extra minutes on the bonus edition Blu-ray or whatever. Yeah.
What's with this bloated? I watched the entire extended cut of Lord of the Rings with you guys. Come on, bloated. You guys, other people get to say that. People who don't like
I'm on Fitbit, Ben. Bloated? Yeah. How dare you?
Yeah. I read today that the Porgs were added because the puffins on Skellig Michael were just too numerous to digitally remove.
That's awesome.
So they had to make them an alien race.
That's fantastic.
It was much easier to just paint a different face on them.
That's amazing.
Than actually to digitally remove every single one.
Well, you know, I don't particularly like the Porgs and how they're used in a couple situations. I'm fine that they exist as a natural wildlife on the island.
Yeah.
And I'm fine that wildlife interacts with all the main characters that are on that island. But what I don't like is how they use them for comic effect infesting the Millennium Falcon, and how when we've got a key scene with the Falcon coming in to save the day and flying around, that we've got Porgs in the cockpit that Chewbacca has to shoo away. I mean, for me, that's just taking it too far.
Exactly.
So if they would have lost that aspect of it, the Porgs would have been fine. But then they wouldn't have enough material to create a merchandising item. And I think that's, you know, I feel cynically that that's the only reason that those characters exist, is to sell Porg dolls.
You're all a bunch of Grinches. I want to own a Porg. Keep making Star Wars stuff, and I will keep throwing money at it. I'm in.
But thanks again for joining me talking about The Last Jedi. Anything else you guys want to mention before we...
Well, I guess the last thing that I'll say, I've seen it twice. Has anybody else seen it more than once?
No.
Humble brag.
And some of the issues that I had about the difficulty of connecting all the story arcs and the editing choices that forced, and the cross-cutting amount that sort of made it difficult for me to feel fully immersed in any one of the threads for a long enough time to feel invested, goes away on the second viewing, or at least for a larger part. And I expect when I see it again, because I'm sure I will, that'll keep diminishing. So I'm less concerned about that now than I initially was after just the first viewing. So I encourage everyone to get out there and see it more than once.
Yeah.
And one thing I'd love to link to in the show notes, Ben sent me a video about editing the original Star Wars, and it's an amazing video. Did he send it to either of you guys? Have you seen it?
Yes. Yeah, it's phenomenal.
Phenomenal, especially just in terms of learning how to edit. And it shows how you turn a bad movie into a good movie, and how cross-cutting in particular can be used to great effect, how Episode 4 did it well. And that would be something great to take with you as we then will rewatch The Last Jedi and find out.
By the way, I'm announcing this now. Dom and I will be taking that 20 extra minutes of footage, combining it with the 2 hours and 34 minutes, I believe the film was. And we, by this time next year, we'll have our own 90-minute quick cut version of The Last Jedi that we will like better. I'm telling you that right now.
It's going to happen.
That will be happening.
Just because you can lose weight doesn't mean The Last Jedi needs to.
I'm saying that right now. Throw this in my face a year from now if we haven't done it.
All I'm saying is kill the past.
Done.
Sweet. All right. With that, thanks again for joining us. Go out and watch the movie multiple times. Disney, take all my money. See you guys.